The Guardian. Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We ask all the big questions on a week where a much-changed Liverpool exited the FA Cup, but a not-so-changed Man City put nine past Burton in the not-so-prestigious Cup. Not much to talk about in the other League Cup semi between Spurs and Chelsea after VAR eradicated any kind of debate about the big decisions. Elsewhere, should Marco Arnautovic go to China, will Arsenal miss Aaron Ramsey, and we'll find out which of the panel didn't have to Google Nathan Jones. All that plus so much more in today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a prestigious panel in front of us. Paul McInnes, how are you?
I'm very well, Melissa. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Here's one thing I'm wondering. Do you think we're going to get through a whole podcast without mentioning TalkSport?
We can try.
Oh, we just did it, obviously, but I'm just wondering.
Is that because you'd like to or you wouldn't?
I'm just
like
wondering.
To?
I just it would break a streak.
Okay, well, we can try that. Lars, I'm really excited you're here because I'm normally the other side of the glass when I used to produce this podcast and hear what you had for breakfast. Now, because I'm standing in for Max today, who's on holiday, I can ask you myself.
But does that mean, because we always call you producer Mel, do we call you presenter Mel now?
Or just Mel? Just Mel's fine.
That's great. That's exciting news. No, I had some leftover pasta this morning, so that was kind of on brand. But I'm excited about you being here and Paul McInnes being here. Does that mean I can just talk about Alex Tetti for a full hour
and
that'll be fine?
I'll be happy with
absolutely.
That.
Tetti time. Absolutely. No Tetti, no party.
Exactly right.
Fantastic. So you have to tell me what you did have for breakfast.
Yeah, pasta, a bit of leftover pasta from yesterday.
Great, because you're on a health kick, right?
It's an annual thing where we sort of go around New Year's and I sort of realise that just physically I'm increasingly a bit of a human wasteland and I kind of want to sort that out. And I never end up doing it, but, you know, you try for a while.
Pasta's not sure that's the healthiest option for breakfast.
Well, but you know, it depends on how snacking is the enemy, right? So if you have a filling breakfast, then you're less likely to make terrible life decisions.
I thought snacking was the hero.
Oh,
I thought
it depends on what you snack.
It evens out the sort of blood sugar peaks and troughs.
I think that depends on the snacks.
Yeah, very true.
Talking of snacks and healthy breakfast, John Ashdown, what did you have?
Well, I had beans on toast this morning, Mel, which is very much like I would have had when I was about 10 years old.
Oh,
but it was still fun.
That's a good tea.
The one thing that I've developed, actually, it's very recently, is I now only have half a tin of beans with my beans and toast and save the other half for
put the rest in the fridge in
another day,
box.
You know, yeah.
That's the sort of tea I have when there's no one at home to cook for me. That or breakfast cereal.
A whole tin of baked beans.
Well, I used to be a whole tin man, and these days I'm a half tin man.
Wow.
Yeah, I've changed.
We're all on a health kick. Let's start with Monday night. Wolves 2, Liverpool 1 in the FA Cup. There's a few talking points in the game itself. It's a good cup tie, actually. Ruben Neves, a pretty good winner, swerved outside the box. Quite a good stat on him. He's now scored 9 goals for Wolves. 8 of them have been outside the box. The other one was a penalty. Liverpool, I said much changed in the intro. That's, I guess, the biggest talking point. Should Jurgen Klopp have put out a stronger side? Should that side have beaten Wolves? Who did really well? They played really well, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, Wolves are a good side. You know, they're doing well in the Premier League and they've had their ups and downs. But there's been games when they've looked vulnerable, but generally they're well organised and they're good in defence and they're excellent on the counter attack. I was surprised because I think Liverpool could have played a stronger team than that, and also they played a formation. They went 4-4-2 and they never play that system, certainly not in the league. So for me, just seeing all that information before the game, you thought, okay, he's really not that bothered about the cup. And obviously, after the game, he says, oh, it's not a choice. I had to do it. With injuries, look, we've got more centre-half injuries. But there was not only a lack of experience in the team, but a slightly experimental flavour to it. And I think we'll see, but it seemed to me slightly nervous that, you know, he was a little bit uncertain. If you look at what City will come to City, but also say Spurs did in the cup. It's a mixture of some inexperienced players, but enough to anchor it and in a system they're familiar with. And after the City defeat, you know, with a Liverpool, and they're obviously putting so much emphasis on winning the title. I don't know if they're not ladling more pressure on themselves.
Yeah, it's one of those as well, isn't it? People will say, well, he's put players in like Origi, like Sturridge, who should want to go out there and try and force their way into the team. And Sturridge in particular was really poor. His stats from the game, he won one header, made 12 passes in the 70 minutes he was on the pitch. Just, you know, what's... You kind of feel for Klopp a bit when he's putting out these players who should be putting in a performance, and then they don't deliver.
Yeah, I mean, there is a bit about Sturridge that remains an enigma after all this time. He's obviously a great finisher, but I'm not sure he wants to play well in a two even necessarily. He was playing with Origi up front, and those two don't have any sort of partnership because they've never played together before. You know, on the other hand, Origi scored a lovely goal, so it worked for him, but. I just think there was so much about it that was a bit experimental that you were running the risk of these things not working, and you know, James Milner getting mugged off in central midfield. You know, that there was lots of downsides for the players who were called into play as well.
Lars, Alan Shearer said after the game, it was a team who looked like they didn't want to go through. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would certainly say that it might not be a bad idea for Liverpool to go out of it. In general, I like the cup competitions, but I do think there's a caveat with Liverpool, given that they're chasing what would be a historic and massively significant league title for them. And just a quick shout out to Christopher Johansson at Bojo Chris on Twitter, who's actually put the numbers together. If you look at the last seven Premier League winners and when they went out of the FA Cup and out of Europe, you'll actually see that 11 out of 14 cup runs were done within mid-March. So it is a trend that the teams that go on to win the league are usually done with all this cup business pretty early on in the season. And specifically with Liverpool, again with Christopher Johansson looking at the numbers, Liverpool under Klopp, they have almost a quarter of a point extra as an average sort of points pickup if they have more than four or more rest days ahead of a game. If they have four or more rest days ahead of a game, they pick up 2.11 points on average from the games, whereas when they have three games or fewer, their average is 1.87. So we know for a fact that Liverpool struggle when they have more games. They're less likely to win if they have fewer days in which to rest. The trend was very similar with Klopp when he was in Dortmund. So I don't think it was a bad idea for Liverpool to go out of this competition.
Team selection itself did sort of suggest a little bit of sort of Klopp throwing his hands up. And he said as much afterwards by saying that the players that he'd brought in, even the experienced players that were brought into the side, were struggling for rhythm. And that just made it harder for the younger players who were brought in, which, you know, you could probably tell, or should have been able to tell beforehand, really. You know, that said, there was a fantastic save late on from Shaqiri. That was Ruddy tipping it onto the post.
Yeah, really good save.
Which is an absolutely stunning save. And, you know, they were inches from taking it to a replay. And it did take a very good Neves goal to beat them. It's interestingly, you know, with Lovren, you know, despite making the changes, he still lost a centre-half as well. So it looks like Fabinho in the back of the weekend.
And just one final thing, just a slight difference. If you're talking about rotation of squads, again looking at City and Spurs, you know, Spurs playing Oliver Skip against Tranmere, or just thinking about, and we'll come to it again, I'm sure, but Zivchenko's goal for Man City. These are players who are being blooded in the Premier League. They're maybe not getting many minutes, but they're getting minutes in the league. And Klopp doesn't tend to do that as much. Klopp tends to stick with, you know that most notably that front three plays when they're fit. And so I think he's also slightly restricted his options because he hasn't been able to sort of blood these players and say, so they are more familiar and able to come into a game like this.
So Liverpool out of the FA Cup. The fourth round draw was done after full time. I'm trying to think back when traditionally fourth round draws were done. It used to be on a Sunday.
Yeah, I guess, if the games were all done by then.
Yeah, it just didn't feel right to me that it was done so late on a Monday. If you're a 10-year-old kid who's just, you know, if you're eagerly awaiting Newport, who have we got in the cup, and you have to go to bed. It's terrible.
Well, to be honest, I couldn't give a fig about the FA Cup, and you know, I'm actually into the Carabao, weirdly, and it'll change for me. But I do think the FA Cup is systematically having its glamour drained from it year on year. It's not as if we haven't had giant killing acts these last few seasons. We've had a lot of them. We've had great runs in the cup, Lincoln, for example. but it just isn't so obviously not important, certainly at these early stages, to the biggest clubs.
Before we move on, Paul, we should mention that one player who Klopp did blood in the Liverpool team was Kiana Hover, who had a great game. It's his debut. He's only 16. He completed the third most passes in the whole game and more than any other Wolves player.
Yeah, congratulations to him. Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, he came on because Dejan Lovren got injured. I mean, and you know, and he thrived. And sometimes you're going to chop people up. But I don't think Curtis Jones, you know, another big prospect for Liverpool, he didn't have much of a game. I think he threw them out there, and he cobbled something together, and he didn't really care that much, and they got what they deserved.
Fair enough.
And possibly even what they want.
Well, maybe, you know. I mean, that remains to be seen.
I should stress, like, I'm going big on this with Liverpool. In general, I'm very much in favour of the Cups, and I'm slightly furious about teams like Bournemouth and Leicester, like, playing reserve sides, because, like, what are you saving yourself for? You know, you're not going to do anything in the league. You're not getting relegated. This is all nonsense. But I think in the case of Liverpool, like, the league title would mean so much to them, and the deep cup run would be detrimental to their chances in the league. It would. So I think from a Liverpool perspective, I think it's completely fine.
Well, they would have got Shrewsbury or Stoke in the next round. So, very winnable tie, albeit it's away. The fourth round ties, let's just have a look at them. Obviously, Arsenal United is the big one. Out of the giant killers, only Luton got a good draw, really, I guess. Chelsea or Sheffield Wednesday. Barnet got Brentford at home. Oldham, a trip to Doncaster. And Newport have to go to Middlesbrough. Oh, you must be gutted if you're a Newport fan. Absolutely gutted.
Well, it's a bit of a journey for a start, isn't it? And then you're not exactly going to be going to watch the thrills and spills of high-end continental football, are you?
Are you trying to suggest that going away to Middlesbrough to watch a Tony Pulis team is not like an amazing day out?
Of all the ties, you talk about glamour ties, that has to be the most unglamorous, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm excited about Swansea Gillingham, if only to follow the further adventures of Gillingham's like cartoonishly tall goalkeeper, Tomas Holy, all 6'9" of him.
6'9", is that what
he's a stupidly tall man, and of course managing to keep Cardiff at bay. You know, maybe there could be another sort of a Welsh job on the cards there. I've always wondered this. You just put very large people in goal. Why don't more people do this?
Because they can't get to the ground quick enough.
It's probably true.
My tie of the round is Barnet, who beat Sheffield United, drew Brentford at home, which means the bees are taking on the bees at the Hive.
Oh,
great. That is why you're on this podcast, Joe.
Are you buzzing for it?
I think everybody's buzzing, aren't they?
Fantastic. Elsewhere, Millwall, Everton, I suppose, will be quite a good tie. Palace, Tottenham, Portsmouth, QPR, Man City, Burnley, Newcastle or Blackburn will play Watford. Acton, Stanley got Derby or Southampton, Bristol City against Bolton and Wimbledon against West Ham. So that's the FA Cup chat over, and that's part one over two. In part two, we'll talk about the Carabao Cup semi-finals. Welcome back to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. I'm Melissa Rudd, standing in for Max Rushton. And I have to mention, Lars, the live shows.
Yes.
Of which you are on both of them.
I believe so, yes.
Fantastic. In Dublin as well.
Yeah, and I'm slightly, like, surprised and confused that both Max and Baz have gone off on holidays now. I mean, I personally, going on away in mid-season just really confuses me. It feels like you've skipped a couple of chapters in the book when you get back. Like, you can still follow the plot lines.
They're on their winter break.
You still understand what's happened, but you're just kind of slightly confused as to how you got there. And I wonder, maybe Max and Barry will be completely clueless when they come back, and how that will impact the live shows. I don't know.
Well, you're not selling it all too well.
Well, it's almost sold out. You know, it's grand.
We should say they're on the...
Oh, actually, a clueless Max and Barry.
Anybody notice?
Jokes write themselves.
Oh, they might have something to say about that when they get back. Well, the 21st and 22nd of January at Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin. Now it's time to talk about the Carabao Cup. And the box, Barry's Carabao Cup box, was left out for us. But I'll be honest, I'm a bit scared to use it because I feel like he'd be waiting for the...
I could simulate it for you if you like.
Yeah, that might be better, actually.
Carabao!
That was great. It was almost as good as... The box is a bit temperamental now anyway, because it's last season's. It doesn't work all too well.
But I'm not sure what would have been the bigger crime against pod norms, would it be actually opening the box or not opening the box? Because none of us are Barry, exactly. And that's definitely true. So I think you've played it safe, Mel. Yeah. I think this is the right thing to do.
I don't want to be too much of a rebel. I've got to come back Monday. You know, when Barry will be back. So
now also, if you are too much, maybe like next time you're producing Max, he'll be completely unruly.
Oh, I can't,
which will also
that.
Be a change from the norm.
True. Well, let's start with the Carabao Cup. We'll start with Spurs 1, Chelsea 0. And we have to talk about VAR because it was by far the biggest talking point in the game. For anybody who hasn't seen it, I'm sure everyone has seen it, but for anyone who hasn't, Harry Kane, the ball's put through to him, the assistant ref's flag goes up, several Chelsea defenders slow down and they stop as Kane goes in, who then gets fouled by the keeper anyway. So VAR not only looked at the offside decision, but also the penalty. It took about a minute and 32, 33 seconds, so not all that long.
Well, I was at the game, so you get a very different experience there. And my recollection is that the flag didn't go up immediately and, in fact, went up by the time he was in the box and maybe even after he was challenged. I'm willing to take correction on this. But the argument was, so the flag then goes up, but the referee is informed by VAR that maybe that decision might be wrong. And this I've seen explained as being good VAR protocol, that you don't penalise, as a linesman, you don't sort of look to penalise the forward in a situation if you're uncertain. You let it run, see what happens. If they get an advantage, then you can put the flag up and you can check it and you can decide whether it was appropriate or not. So I think that might have actually been good practice. It was my feeling in the ground that it was a marginal one either way. And I kind of feel like we waste too much of our precious time on earth discussing marginal offside calls. I kind of think how many years ago was it now, John, where the rule was that, you know, you gave the sort of advantage to the forward or Melissa, can you remember? But anyway, it's like that, but it's no longer like that.
Benefit
if you've got a finger beyond the line, you're off.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit pernickety. But certainly the VAR looked back and he said, he's on. He sees Aspilicueta plays him on. And then, you know, it just all goes a bit crazy afterwards because Sarri turns up in his press conference with a laptop saying, look, we've got a different angle from the same moment.
Yeah, the Chelsea tactical camera, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, which shows that he's apparently off. Now, I'm not even sure looking at that. I mean, I may be wrong again. Looking at that, I'm not even sure he looks off then. I'm not sure you can be 100% sure. Did the linesman make a clear and obvious error? That's the question. And because he's put the flag up, did he make a clear and obvious error? No, he didn't. So maybe the goal, maybe the penalty shouldn't have occurred. But I kind of feel like it should have done. I mean, I think it's also debatable how much contact Kepa actually got on.
I did think this until this morning and it is a Spurs fans video that I've watched.
From an angle you've never seen before.
And it is a really slowed version and it's a very different angle, almost sort of from behind Kane, as if you're behind his shoulders. And he does get swiped out. He does. He sort of takes his right leg, which then obviously...
Not so swiped out that he still isn't able to adjust his position into a perfect, you know...
I thought the same as you. I thought he's bought that one. But then the angle, when you see it straight from behind, you can see that the goalkeeper's coming from the side and it clears him out a bit.
Well, I think he's definitely bought it. But, you know, it's the question is, you know, was there no contact whatsoever? No, probably not. But definitely seen them given.
Talking of angles, though, that poses the question, why... I don't know if it was... I'm not sure if it's exactly what the VAR was seeing or if it was Sky's decision to show those replays, but for about 9 replays they showed the angle where you can't see because the keeper, it was, you know, the angle that the fourth official would have seen. I was like, why are we not seeing it from the other side? Presumably the VAR cameras were showing it from the other side, but
I've seen it written that they didn't have that angle available to them that the Chelsea team had. But, you know, I don't think, you know, nobody actually, it's very rare that people get let inside these VAR HQ, so we don't quite know specifically what they've seen. Okay. But I just to say, I think to make this the centerpiece of what actually happened in the match, I think is a bit of a distraction from what was really, you know, Chelsea played well. Chelsea had the best of the possession, but he didn't really create that many chances. And I'm not sure that a 1-0 defeat wasn't probably about the right result.
Yeah.
I wonder if in part there's a sense of it being a bit of distraction work from Sarri in a way.
Exactly.
Just because it's a coaching error. If, you know, the players know there's a VAR system in play, and it's clear that three or four Chelsea defenders stop. But presumably the flag has gone up at, you know, before the contact, because you can tell, I think Rüdiger and Alonso on this near side, you can tell they've stopped. But I don't know if they're getting to Kane anyway.
Mm.
Then the penalty kind of gets them off the hook a little bit, because if Kane goes round and stumbles and then taps it in and all the defenders have stopped, then you've got a whole different set of issues at play. But Sarri surely has got to say to his players before the game that this is the system and you don't stop until the referee tells you to stop. I know it's difficult. I mean, we've got a new queuing system in the local supermarket and it's chaos. And these players have been drilled, you know, once the flag goes up, you know, you're all right. But, you've got to try, surely.
But are you sure that it's not possible that they might have been countered, actually instructed on this? And it's like, well, if you feel that it's going to go against you, then stop the play and then go to the referee, VAR, and go and look back. I mean, there's definitely, you know, a lot of lobbying that goes on in VAR.
That would be very stupid, though, because it's not the referee's decision to go to VAR.
Well, if VAR have got in touch with him and said, you know, there's something you might want to review.
Oh, sure, yeah.
If they haven't made that message,
yeah,
then fine. But they can put that message to him and the referee can go, no, I've seen it, I'm happy with it, I'm not going
to
review it.
I think the ref should just nip this in the bud and give yellow cards immediately to any player who ever asks for VAR and just...
Well, that's what they're supposed to do, but they're not.
It's the same with swearing, though, wasn't it? They were supposed to do that as soon as a player swears, get booked that or sent off. That never happens. So it's just one of those things. But you said Chelsea didn't create many chances. Probably the best chance they did create fell to Christensen. Terrible miss.
Awful.
About six yards out.
Yeah, that was the one cross that evaded everybody in the penalty area. And yeah, it was, you know, he was completely free and should have put it away. And there was also a good save from Gazzaniga off a deflected Callum Hudson-Odoi effort. But really, you know, given that most of the play was in Spurs' defensive third in the second half, they didn't create an awful lot. And I think that'll be a little bit... On the one hand, you can look at it and say, well, Spurs, you know, really struggle to impose themselves in play. But I think there's a bit of them that's like, well, that's... They can also go, well, we took Chelsea's best shot and they, you know, they couldn't knock us down. Callum Hudson-Odoi had a... you know, it was quite interesting to see him play after all the kerfuffle that's been going on about potential transfer. It was a surprise. And there was a bit of it's like, well, why is he picking him in this particular game? I thought it was interesting because he hasn't really started him in many other, certainly not in high-profile matches, sorry. And the first 20 minutes he played really well, looked really dangerous, getting a lot of space on the right. Faded after that, and maybe you get that as a teenager. But one thing I thought was quite noticeable was when you're playing a false nine, as they were with Eden Hazard, if you have a winger, which Callum Hudson-Odoi is, from what I've seen, you know, he wants to get crosses in, he doesn't want to get into the box, then you're sort of nullifying your own system because you don't have somebody running beyond that forward, or you've got one fewer option running beyond that forward.
I think he's worth the 35 million bid from
in this day and age, Melissa, almost certainly. Yes.
Well, there's more bad news for Spurs this week when they found out Wembley not going to be ready till, I think it's at least mid-March. Staying with transfer lines, Moussa Dembélé apparently off to China for around 9 million. A lot of Spurs fans disappointed by this. He was one of their best players last season. He hasn't played since the 3rd of November. Made only 13 appearances this season. He'll be 32 in July. He's reportedly on 80 grand a week at Spurs, so he's one of the club's top earners. Haven't they had the best of him?
I was about to say, my initial reaction seeing those news is that Spurs have done a tremendous job getting any Italian transfer fee for him. He's a guy who physically, you know, he picks up a heck of a lot of injuries, and physically when he is fit, he doesn't look like he's quite there anymore in terms of where you need to be to play at this level in England. It's 6 months left of his contract. I don't think... there's nothing to suggest Spurs were even considering handing him a new contract. So actually getting some kind of transfer fee for him now is great business, I'd say.
Yeah, I think there was a suggestion that Dembélé was offered a deal and didn't take it a year ago or so. And that, you know, that's the last thing you do to Pochettino is, once you've got into negotiation, say, I don't want to stay at the club, or I want better.
And they've already sort of started blooding the replacements coming through from the youth ranks as well. So that perhaps a little bit, it contrasts between the two teams. So you've got Chelsea who are... you know, trying to find a way of keeping Hudson-Odoi and holding on to some of their older players, and Tottenham more than happy to let one of their older guys go because they've got these young kids that they're more than happy to throw in.
Lars, have you seen much of Franck Kessié in Serie A?
So I liked him a lot when he was at Atalanta initially. He looked like a sort of almost like a potential future Vieira type, like a really physically strong, hustling sort of up and down midfielder. And he's not, I thought, when Milan had their initial sort of, we're going to be back again and we're going to spend lots of money splash, I thought that's an amazing signing. And he hasn't quite kicked on there. But then nothing's been very good at Milan. So I'm kind of, I think he's a great prospect, yeah.
Because Spurs have been linked a couple of times in the
I'd love that signing from Spurs' perspective. I think he'd potentially just completely perfect for Pochettino's system. Very energetic. A little bit rough around the edges, but you know, a coach like Pochettino, you'd imagine, could smooth that over. I think that'd be a really exciting
signing. Is he good on the ball?
Good enough, yeah. Not like Dembele, I can go past anyone at any given moment. But he's more of like a significant upgrade on Wanyama, I'd say. You know, put it that way.
Moving on to Chelsea, you said, John, they want to keep Hudson-Odoi. They apparently don't want to keep Alvaro Morata. He could be going on loan to Atletico Madrid with a view to buy at the end of the season, which means Chelsea can then go for Higuain for $50 million or Callum Wilson. $50 million for Callum Wilson. What?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, he's an England international. He's scored goals in the Premier League, so he's got that proven track record, I suppose. And is different to what they to perhaps what they already have. It feels like Higuain is a more sort of Chelsea signing. I think there's sort of some talk of him coming on loan till the end of the season. But yeah, $50 million for Callum Wilson. I don't know if it isn't unreasonable in the current day and age.
There was a sports TV channel reporting last night that Bournemouth apparently are holding out for $70 million.
Yeah, I mean that's some good negotiating. And as people are pointing, I mean I rate Callum Wilson and I think he is capable of doing a job in a top six side. Perhaps not every single game, but I think he could add something to Chelsea. But if you were to sell him for between 50 and 70 and buy Dominic Solanke for 19, that's good business for Bournemouth.
I guess, as always, English players are worth far more than their weight in gold, partially because the quotas the big clubs have to follow. If you're Chelsea, you want a guy. If you're Chelsea are in trouble with this, if I don't recall correctly. They have too few homegrown players at the moment, or at least very close to the limit they need to be at. And you want to sign a striker, you want him to be English, and you want him to be good enough to play for Chelsea. Like, what kind of market are you looking in? There aren't that many of them. So yeah, good job on Bournemouth for holding out for a lot of money there, I'd say. But you do wonder, if you're Tammy Abraham, like, you know, Callum Wilson is good and way ahead than Tammy Abraham at this point in time, I guess, because he scored quite a lot of goals in the Premier League and Tammy's not quite done it yet. But just watching Tammy Abraham play for Aston Villa, like, he's not a million miles away from...
Yeah, but he's a different type of player, isn't he? And I think Sarri likes those players who are mobile and can interchange positions, which say, well, why would you sign Higuain then? But you know, I wonder about whether Abraham would completely fit into the system, seeing the way he's reluctant to use Giroud, even.
It's such a Chelsea thing to spend a lot of money on a player who's better than what they have, but for them to not give that guy a chance, maybe even sell him and then end up buying him back for a lot of money. So I don't know. Like, at some point, Chelsea should be giving these guys chances, no?
I haven't got the stats at my fingertips, but I bet Tammy Abraham's goal-scoring record in the Championship is better than Callum Wilson's was at this stage of their career.
He only did a season, though.
Yeah, I suppose.
Because he came from Cov and then they went straight up. I mean, you know, he hasn't scored double figures in the Premier League, Callum Wilson. But I've seen him play for Bournemouth a few times, but I was really impressed with him when he played for England. I thought he's got enough. He's got pace, and he's got that sort of striker's awareness and instinct. But I think, you know, he's cute off the ball nowadays, I think.
But what do we think this means about Hazard, though? Because Chelsea are no longer a club that can just spend money willy nilly. They're not. They have to recoup a lot of it. If they've already committed to spending a lot of money on Pulisic, if they're also thinking about spending a similar sum of Callum Wilson, I mean, are they expecting a large incoming chunk of cash, perhaps?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, they probably are, but they might sell Tammy Abraham or, you know, them who else, or Ruben Loftus-Cheek, or, you know, with caveats about homegrown stuff. And you suspect that one or both of Willian and Pedro will leave.
Higuain broke the Serie A goal scoring record under Sarri at Napoli He scored 36 goals in 2015-16. He's now unknown at Milan because he went to Juventus for 75 million. Ronaldo's there. He's kind of surplus to requirements. But it'd be exciting to see him in the Premier League, wouldn't it?
It would, but my concern would be that he would follow in the proud Roman Abramovich era Chelsea tradition of signing a very good striker slightly too late. You know, in the sort of Shevchenko, yeah, Fernando Torres mode. Falcao as well, he was there, you forget that. He just hasn't looked great at Milan. He's on a lot of money, and Juventus's main reason for wanting him out the door is that they're spending so much money on Ronaldo's salaries. He's a drag on their wage budget, so presumably they wouldn't want to subsidise any of those wages, so Chelsea would have to take them on. There's a certain logic, obviously, with the Sarri connection, but it's one of those... I think that would be sort of a quietly very expensive deal for Chelsea to do, and for a player who looks like he might be past it, I'm not sure about that.
Well, moving on to last night's action. Man City, Burton. John, you watched this one.
Yeah.
9-0. I mean, what is there to say about... For periods of the game, it just looked like when you're in a training session and you were told offence... defence and get balls into the box, and the defence weren't allowed to bring it above the defence, you know, above the halfway line. That's what it looked like for some of it, which is, you know, that's no disrespect to Burton, obviously, but there was a huge gulf in class, and they didn't help themselves a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there were parts of the second half when City were just bombing forward and the defence was non-existent. You know, they scored 9, but they could have had a few more. Weirdly, Burton were quite good until 2-0, which came after about half an hour. Between the first goal and the second goal, they had a fantastic chance, which Marcus Harness blazed over the bar from not much more than sort of 8-10 yards out, when he really should have scored. And it might not have made a huge difference in the grand scheme of things, obviously, because that one goal, you know, 9-1, it might just have been 9-1 instead. But it would have given Burton something to hang on to. And then once they had those two goals just before half-time, that Zinchenko effort from distance, I think, sort of made the shoulders slump a little bit, because it was like, well, if they're going to score from there and do things like that as well. And then the second half was kind of, there was an element of it being sort of slightly painful for the neutral, but it was also quite fun when it got to 8, because you think, can they get 10? Can they get 10? And they didn't quite get there. But yeah, it's going to make for a slightly flat second leg, you might think.
The issue of Carabao Cup second leg semi-finals anyway, is there any need for us to have two-legged semi-finals in this competition?
Well, it does feel like overkill. It's sort of a traditional sort of throwback, isn't it? It's always been this way, so we'll always carry on doing it. And I don't really think that it necessarily makes the competition any more sort of special to have this random sort of two-legged semi-final. And although obviously the City Burton game is going to be a bit of a non-event, unless you're a Burton Albion fan who, you know, will turn up at the ground and, you know, might be quite decent for them. But the Chelsea Spurs game will be interesting in the second leg.
And it does give you high value games at this point in the year. That's why I'm pro Carabao and down on the FA, because
surely a one-legged semi would be a higher value game, though.
No, but I mean, just for idiots in their pants watching football on television, right. It's like there's another thing to watch. I mean, and that, you know, it does fill up those off weeks during the autumn as well. I'm, you know, big into Carabao.
Also big into Carabao. Both really the animal, the drink, the band, and the cup. I'm full Carabao package. I'm here for it.
John, you said, you know, could they get 10? There was a debate. I'm going to rephrase that. Is there a debate? Because there was a certain tweet last night that went on Twitter where somebody suggested that should City have eased up? Is there a sense of professionalism in that they were kind of taking the mick a little bit?
I've seen a few suggestions of this in the comments underneath the match report last night that we put online. People, quite a few people were saying that it was in some way disrespectful of City to carry on scoring, which just seems baffling to me.
Yeah,
surely it's more taking the mickey and more disrespectful just to knock the ball around between after it gets to 5-0 to stop trying to score. I think you know, and there is a culture of it. I think in Italy, if once you get to 4 or 5-0, you sort of ease up. But I think, you know, I didn't find anything wrong with City just carrying on and going for as many as they could, particularly in a two-legged game, I suppose.
Yeah,
I mean, as long as you're not the worst thing you could do is either to knock it about or, you know, playing keepy-oppy and just getting all the tricks out, which I think is a bit sort of taking the mick. But just scoring goals is fine.
I agree with John wholeheartedly. And I think there's another aspect to it, which is what the Pochettino alluded to about bringing on Harry Kane. You know, admittedly, it looks like half the Burton fans were stuck on the M6 trying to get to the game and missed most of it. But, you know, it's not... Burton are not going to often get to see Leroy Sané in full flow. And, you know, he was majestic. And, you know, that's something that the fans can take away and say, oh, well, you know, we got Tonk, but I did get to see that great City team against my team.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when there's a gulf in leagues as well, I mean, we got Tonked. And when I say we, of course, me, Norwich. Norwich got Tonked at Man City 7-1. 7-0 5 years ago. No one was saying then they should have eased up. When Colchester spanked us 7-1 at Carrow Road in...
I think we're all saying ease up then.
Yeah, I wish they had eased up at five at half-time. But, you know, I think it's a ridiculous argument to put out there.
You know, and I was at the Man City when we got beat 6-2 by Man City and Carlos Tevez scored a hat-trick. But when I think Russell Martin poked one in and you know, when we scored, that was brilliant. And I think, you know, had that chance gone in, which it should have done for Burton, you know, that would have been a great little thing to talk about.
Yeah, it was not a night to remember for Burton fans. As you said, a lot of them got stuck. There's a couple of fans who made it 15 minutes before the end, so technically I think they saw a 1-0 defeat. So
well worth it. Yeah. No, there was a funny, you mentioned the Italian thing of easing up after a few goals. There was a funny exception to that rule a few years back when Francesco Guidolin was in charge of Udinese, and they had a fun team anyway because they had Toto Di Natale and Alexis Sanchez up front, which is a fun striking duo, and they went away to Palermo and won 7-0, and it was quite odd because they didn't ease up at all. But the reason for that, I suspect, is that Palermo had previously sacked Guidolin three times, so he didn't feel particularly charitable to them on that day.
Just one more note on Man City. Phil Foden didn't start. There was a lot of tweets about this as well. People saying it's a disgrace. Why isn't he starting the game? He did come on and scored.
But that was clearly Pep Guardiola respecting the proud heritage of the Carabao Cup by you know, taking it very, very seriously and not risking an unblooded youngster such as Foden in such a massive game.
What did he play Eric Garcia, though, instead, in that position?
Yeah, another it's not a flawless theory, I'll give you that. But no, I thought it was weird. I thought it was really weird. I know he played on at the weekend, but if you're Phil Foden, like, if you're not getting 90 minutes in a game like this, like, when are you going to get time on the pitch for this team? I mean, surely he has to start. I mean, I'm sure it's great training, like when you're a young, promising kid, being coached by Guardiola every day and training with all these amazing players. But surely he needs to be playing regularly at some point.
And your theory does hold, because Eric Garcia was playing centre-half, so...
Well, Man City play Wolves on Monday night. Time for a bit of managerial news. This happened this week. Gary Rowett sacked by Stoke. Nathan Jones, the new manager there. He leaves Luton to take charge of them. Nathan Jones was trending... I've mentioned Twitter a lot, but I'll mention it again. Nathan Jones was trending on Twitter when this appointment was made. A lot of people not having heard of them. I suppose Luton aren't a traditional kind of fashionable club, should we say. Not traditional, but they're not a fashionable club. But Luton are doing well this season as well. They're second. They've got the most goals in League One. And this seems to be quite an encouraging appointment, a young English manager getting a chance, John.
Yeah, he's done a terrific job at Kenilworth Road in the past couple of years. On course for back-to-back promotions. And, you know, one of the most sort of pleasing thing, I suppose, if you're a Stoke fan, if you're looking for an endorsement, is that every single Luton fan that I've seen an opinion of is devastated to see him go, really. He's done his time in the game. You know, he's 45. He's not a sort of early 30s manager. He's done a lot of coaching at Brighton before getting his first managerial gig. And he's got a talented team at Stoke. I mean, it's obviously not really worked for them this season under Rowett so far, but they didn't really have an exodus after relegation. There's still, you know, there's talent there. It's whether he can harness it. It's an interesting challenge for him to see if a manager without much sort of big name cachet in the game can get some of those kind of slightly higher profile players to perform for him.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's really interesting. But another really interesting thing is that classic Stoke dilemma of when they existed in the Premier League, you know, can you transition their style?
Yeah.
Because I think the Rowett's recruited an awful lot of traditional Stoke, or kept a lot of the Stoke players and recruited traditional Stoke style players.
Yeah.
And
Jones, he's got a lot of criticism for it as well in the way they've played this season.
Well, exactly. So Jones is going to have to work with tools that are not necessarily suited to his style of play, where he likes to play through play through the ranks, plays a midfield diamond, I think, with a two up front. A possession-based game is not something that naturally Stoke have been... it's not something that Stoke have been doing much of this season, so that'll be another challenge for him.
Well, they're 14th, 8 points off the top. You know, we spoke about him being a young English manager who needs a chance. It's a little bit ironic, really, in that Gary Rowett was that. He got the chance at Birmingham, did very well there. It's kind of all gone a bit sour for him after that. Harshly treated there, but, you know, he's kind of failed at Derby. He's now left Stoke. What's next for him, do you think?
Yeah, he's got a bit of a rebuilding job on his hands, for a personal rebuilding job on his hands, hasn't he? He's probably looking at a League One job next up. But I think, you know, he has had periods of success in the past. He's got a chance still to you know, come back up again.
And for Stoke as well, it's imperative they get this right. Tony Pulis, second spell, lasted seven seasons. Then they had Mark Hughes for 4.5 years. Paul Lambert was only there for 15 games. Rowett only there for 29 games. So they need a bit of stability, don't they?
Yeah, and I think the owner's daughter, who runs Bet365, is, I think, the most... expensively remunerated executive in Britain, which is a good sign if you're thinking that you're probably going to have to dip into your owner's pockets over the next few windows to rebuild this club. Because it was interesting. I was at Pride Park last weekend, and Frank Lampard, in his post-match remarks, suddenly started talking about all the big boys who were over Derby's shoulder. And I was like, aren't you guys a big boy? But anyway, Stoke was one of the teams he was talking about. I struggle to see Stoke going on a run and getting into the playoffs. And if they do, then it's all gravy. But if not, I think there's going to be a massive amount of restructuring that has to go on, and it won't be cheap.
Well, Stoke go to Brentford on Saturday. We'll talk more about the Championship in part three. Just a note on another cup competition, the Checkatrade Trophy, which is...
the big one.
Of course, the big one. A big one and a huge derby as well, because it was Sunderland against Newcastle under-21s in the last 16. Sunderland won 4-0. They named a really strong team. He made six changes to the side that started Saturday's one-all draw at Charlton, but all of the players that he put out there had played during the season. It was 0-0 at half-time, though, so there was a few nervy moments that they might pull off a shock, the Newcastle under-21s. I think the best bit, though, is... The travelling Newcastle fans who chanted "We saw you cry" on Netflix Sunderland were sticking four past them, so fair play to them. Well, sticking with the cup, but this time in France, there have been some big shocks this week in their competitions. PSG have lost their first cup game since the 22nd of January 2014. They are knocked out of the Coupe de la Ligue by Guingamp. Have I said that right, everyone?
Yeah.
Yes.
Fine. Better than Max.
And it was actually Marcus Thuram, son of Lilian Thuram, missed a penalty in the 61st minute for Guingamp. Neymar scored in the 62nd. Then Guingamp equalised with a penalty in the 81st minute and won another penalty in the 93rd when Marcus Thuram stepped up again and scored it. So a lot of bottle to do that, Lars.
Bottle.
Absolutely. And there was also fun and games in Monaco for once. I mean, they're having a dreadful year on so many levels, but they knocked out Rennes with a young kid scoring a crucial Panenka, Sofiane Diop, who's an ex-Rennes prospect who scored a Panenka against his former club. That was nice. And they also had their, I believe, third choice goalkeeper, Loic Badiachile, who saved a couple of penalties and then scored the winning penalty himself. I think that's always a boss move when a goalkeeper does that. I'm a huge fan. So is there a ray of light in just a miserable existence in Monaco for Henri? And, you know, I don't know, in Monaco to both go down and win the cup? How'd be that? How'd that be?
They're in the quarterfinals now, aren't they? With PSG out, they might have a sniff.
Absolutely. So he could get a trophy.
They're also through to the last 32 of the Coupe de France after beating Canet Roussillon of the fifth tier. Not so lucky for Marseille, though, who lost to fourth division side Andrazeur. They couldn't even play at their home ground because it was adjudged to be too small. Marseille were last season's runners-up in the Europa League. They're already out of all three cup competitions they were in this season.
Yeah, and I don't think Rudy Garcia's job is particularly safe at the moment. It's not going very well there. Can I just mention, just because I'm a simpleton, in the Coupe de France, when Guingamp beat Pontivien, there was a goal scorer for Pontivien called Kevin Lesauce, which is just the best thing. And he's clearly playing in the French lower leagues, probably not very good, but I still want him to somehow end up playing next to Kevin Lasagna up front for someone. He'd have to move up in his career, and he's 28, so that doesn't seem like it might happen. But Kevin Lasauce and Kevin Lasagna,
oh, we can
and
dream.
With maybe like Declan Rice in midfield or something, it could be very good.
Would you have Rice and Lasagna at
you
the same
could.
Time?
I just couldn't think
carb-y.
Of a footballer named Chips.
That's so carb heavy, rice and lasagna.
This is a guy who eats pasta for breakfast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We don't all live by your rules, Lars.
My girl, I went to Ireland in the summer with my other half and her brother. We went and ate food with the family and her brother. I saw him have like a curry that had potatoes in it. And it had rice, and he also had some bread with it.
Whoa.
The dreaded triple carb. And it's
is
a
that
thing.
What you aspire to?
No, I try to avoid it.
A new Lars Civitan. Anyway, that'll do for part two. And part three, we'll look ahead to all the Premier League fixtures this weekend. And also the Championship, there's some big fixtures there too. Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start by looking ahead to the Premier League games this weekend. The first one, West Ham-Arsenal, that's at Saturday lunchtime. West Ham have received a £35 million bid from an unnamed Chinese club for Marko Arnautovic. They've rejected it, so they want to keep him. But if you're Arnautovic, Paul, and you're no doubt being offered absolutely humongous wages...
I think it's very interesting that this bid has happened at all or become public at all, because it's obvious to me that West Ham don't want to sell him. He's their best player. That West Ham are all about telling people we're going someplace. Mm-hmm. We are growing as a club. You don't do that by selling Marko Arnautovic to China. So I wonder what Arnautovic thinks about this, to be honest. And it may be that, yeah, he wants to treble his salary. It may be that he wants to go to Man United. It may just be that there's also some sort of games going on about his status in the club. But it strikes me that this information wouldn't come out. I think it's quite likely this information wouldn't come out unless somebody hadn't wanted it to.
Right.
I find it odd that. There's also the weird thing with sort of Andy Carroll as well and what his sort of role is at the club now.
Finding an exit door?
Well, no, they seem to want to... Pellegrini seems to say that he wants to keep him. That may be because he wants to talk the price up. But I saw him the other week. He brought him on his first start in a year, took him off after 45 minutes because he was awful. Yeah. They don't play to his style anymore. But it's weird. I think there's something going on there.
Arnautovic will be 30 in April, so he's not... You know, this could be his last big... payday as well. So if you're him, surely your head's going to be turned.
Yeah, so in general, I don't begrudge players for wanting to maximise their income at all, especially at the stage of his career that he is. But the thing that would make it a shame with Arnautovic is that he's a guy who promised so much when he was young, and then he spent a lot of his career faffing about. Like the time in Bremen was just a complete waste of time, and he did a lot of nonsensical things, and it just didn't go very well. And he's steadily sort of rehabilitated himself to move out of the sort of Nicholas Bentner bracket and into the sort of very useful player bracket. And I mean, the spell he's having with West Ham now is the most... it's the first time in his career almost where he's been consistently playing up towards, you know, where he should be at, given the natural ability that he has. And so it would be a shame if he then immediately goes off to China, because... You feel that there's a player there who could be playing at a very big club and who should at some point do that, or at the very least become a massive talisman for West Ham over a number of years. But at the same time, listen, if he's got a chance to get paid, he's 29, he's had some injuries, I think fair play to him if he wants that.
I mean, you know, Chelsea pay £35 million for Arnautovic, that would be a good deal for them.
Absolutely.
Well, moving on to Arsenal, Aaron Ramsey in the papers this morning, set to join Juventus on a free transfer after 10 years at the club, reportedly been offered £140,000 a week, which I was just saying to you, Lars, doesn't seem like that much. I thought I'd heard that Arsenal offered him more than that.
Yeah, but I believe the standard in Italy is that they report the net figures, so after tax. So whereas in England, we tend to talk about the pre-tax numbers.
Right.
So he's actually been offered just... about twice that, really, and that's if that's not true, then Juventus have got themselves a completely amazing deal that doesn't make any sense. But I would think, according to smart people on the internet, that is the how it is. And if you look at it from Arsenal's perspective, then you're talking about a player who's 28 who's always really struggled to stay fit, he's always picked up injuries, who's been handed a 5-year deal at well over 200 grand a week. Like, you can understand why that's not something Arsenal can match. I mean, given that their finances are not as great as they were, it's understandable.
Yeah, they have got another big player, though, who struggles to stay fit, who they did offer a big deal to.
Yeah, I wrote about this last week. It's really odd because Ozil doesn't seem to be a good fit for Emery's system because he wants to be able to press high and have this sort of energetic style. But the fact that he's on this massive deal means they're going to have trouble making him go away, basically. Whereas with Ramsey, in theory, he should fit Emery's way of playing much better, but they weren't able to tie him down on any kind of deal. So that's an awkward and annoying situation for Arsenal, I'm sure.
Do you think he'll play at Juve? Do you think he'll be sort of first 11, or will he be a sort of a squad player?
Yeah, I think just looking at the team that there's a third spot alongside Matuidi and Pjanic, which is currently sort of Emre Can, but could be that Bettenker, who's also a very good player. But I don't think they have somebody who can progress the ball in midfield quite as well as Ramsey, certainly not quite as well as Ramsey can. But I mean, you know, I think it's a no-brainer for Ramsey. I mean, not only is it cool to go to the continent nowadays, but, you know, he's going to a club that's incredibly well run, that is very, very competitive. Yeah, the Serie A isn't as competitive as the Premier League, but it's still a very good league. And, you know, two Champions League finals in 4 years, I think it's a great, great opportunity for him.
And he leaves Arsenal a legend, doesn't he? Any player who scores the winning goal in two FA Cup finals can't
absolutely
be described as.
And of course,
else.
Welshman at Juve with John Charles and Ian Rush picking up that mantle.
Good pedigree. 252 top flight games for the club. He scored 52 goals. I think he started the FA Cup game at Blackpool on Saturday, and the Arsenal fans were singing his name throughout. So I do think he'll be missed there. Looking at the other games, Brighton against Liverpool, quite a tough fixture for Liverpool. You can hear the word crisis being bandied about already.
Imagine if getting knocked out of the cup by Wolves slightly knocked their momentum a little bit.
Just imagine.
I don't think it did, but it's true. Brighton have only lost twice at home all season, and that was against Spurs and Chelsea, so it's not a fun place to go.
And they got thumped 5-0 by Liverpool last year, so they've got a revenge motive.
Absolutely. And there's two big games at the bottom this weekend as well. Burnley against Fulham. Burnley 16th on 18 points. Fulham a second bottom with 14 points. Fulham did beat Burnley 4-2 back in August, but Burnley are on a little bit of a roll now, John. They're looking for their fourth straight win in all competitions.
Yeah, back-to-back wins in the league when, you know, a few weeks ago you'd think they were in dire trouble and it would take a bit of a miracle to keep them up. And now you think they're one of the more likely teams to stay up. Fulham are dreadful away from home, and obviously that FA Cup defeat at the weekend sort of adds to the doom and gloom, really. I can see them struggling there. I think Burnley will win that, and if they do, then, you know, they're all of a sudden they're not a million miles away from mid-table.
Talking of doom and gloom, Huddersfield go to Cardiff. They're already 8 points from safety, Huddersfield.
Yeah.
It's going to look absolutely dreadful, isn't it?
I mean, they are absolutely dreadful. I'm sorry, but they are. And I was never a big fan of them last year either. And I know they got some great results. But I think Wagner, he looks like he's pushing up at the limits of what he can do. I think they were a great side in the Championship, very attacking team. He made them hard to beat last season. But there's just not enough creativity in the team, and there's certainly not a goal threat. Was it 8 defeats on the bounce now in the league? I think it'll be 9. Because say what you like about Cardiff, but they've got it's not quite momentum, but they've got a spirit inside them that makes them they're keeping going and they're grafting.
And they're at home as well, which helps massively. Saturday's other fixtures: Palace against Watford, Leicester against Southampton, and Chelsea Newcastle is the evening game. On to Sunday: Everton against Bournemouth, and then the big one: Tottenham against Man United. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's had a great start.
Yes.
As United manager, this is his first big test, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We've mentioned it before, the golden retriever theory of management. So it's been so far, and that people were so fed up with Mourinho and everything he represented, that just by being there and being a lovely fella, Solskjaer has already made them a lot better. But that obviously is not necessarily going to be enough against Tottenham. And the thing that's interesting going into this match is a couple of things. One of them is that if you look at what he's done tactically, he's pushed the fullbacks further up or allowed them to go further up the pitch. He's also allowed the wingers to stay further up when out of possession. These are all things that can backfire spectacularly against Tottenham, of course, who are very, very dangerous and have a lot of pace in the team. So I'll be intrigued to see if he moderates himself a little bit more there or if he keeps pushing on. The other thing is they've been away for warm weather training this week in Dubai, which has been controversial in Norway because we generally don't think going and supporting Gulf states is a great thing to do. It's less of a talking point in this country, I understand, but where I'm from, we don't like that sort of thing. But they've been away to Dubai. And I remember when he was at Cardiff, one of his big problems was that he wanted to change everything and he had very little time on the training ground. And when he did, the conditions were very bad. They had record rainfall in South Wales that winter. So they really had a hard time, you know, teaching the team anything, really. And that was, I'm sure that was partially his shortcomings as well, but it was, the conditions were not good. Now he's actually been away and been able to spend time on stuff with United, and that's why it's really interesting to see how they line up, how they play, what they do tactically, because he's actually had time to work on stuff. He has some selection dilemmas there. I know whether you start Lukaku, you know, how you go about things. I would suspect he'll might be tempted to go with the sort of mobile front three of Martial, Rashford and Lingard, just because you're playing Tottenham, who you know want to push up. We saw in Norway when he was at Molde, he does like rotating, he does like changing his team often to suit the opponent. I suspect he'll do something like that.
I think it's really interesting to see what Spurs do as well, because yeah. I think if Spurs played their best team against Chelsea the other night, that's their best 11. Chelsea swamp them in midfield, amid, you know, 3-on-2 for starters. But I think, you know, that the Winks Sissoko combination is like, Winks sort of lacks the mobility and Sissoko lacks the sort of the distribution. And I think there's a possibility to get them. And if you can dominate that midfield, then that might dictate the way the match goes. So I'd be really interested to see if Pochettino lines up differently. Maybe he might bring Ali back into the, or Dele, sorry. Maybe he might bring Dele back into the centre of the pitch. It'd be interesting to see who is more assertive in the way they go about the game.
Pochettino as well. I mean, could we be looking at here United's manager next season? One of these two. Solskjaer isn't, I know that, you know, he's only contracted till the end of the season and he's going to have to do really, really well for them to consider him. But Pochettino, he said some interesting things in his press conference on Monday before the Cup game. That reading between the lines, I mean, he referred to how little money Spurs have spent. He said the line, if we want to win titles, we need to operate in a different way. He joked that he was going to ask Arsene Wenger if it was worth it in reference to their new stadium. A few things there, which if you're a Spurs fan, you might be thinking, hang on a minute, we need, you know, he's not going to have money to spend. They've spent it all on the stadium, which now isn't going to be ready until the middle of March.
Yeah, I'm still not sure. I mean, I think it could be possible. I think if it's anything right now, it's negotiation. And it could be negotiation with United, but it could also be a negotiation with Daniel Levy. And yeah, they've got £600 million worth of debts, but that's slightly, but that'll be loans that they've secured. It's not necessarily out of the running costs of the club. I think he said several times that he wants to be in that stadium and he wants to take them and wants to take the club into a new era. Yeah. And that's when he would expect the club to be challenging for trophies. That's when you can judge the team according to whether they've won trophies or not. So I think there's been a lot of what he said that sort of leads you to expect he'd do one season in it. And the later it goes, you know, if they've only got sort of half a dozen games, that's not really much of a chance. So I don't think it's a given either way. And I think the fact you read now that United have got an expanded shortlist and stuff makes me think they haven't necessarily had the response that they've wanted. And just on the OGS front as well, you know, it's more of a collegiate approach as well. I'd still think United with Ed Woodward, they'll want a marquee name, but you know, you've got Mike Phelan there, you've got Carrick as well. This is sort of a more of a team United approach that, you know, that you could sort of see that there's a different way of going about things.
Well, on Monday night it's Man City against Wolves, we've mentioned that one. On to the Championship. Some really big fixtures this weekend. 8 of the top 10 teams are playing each other. Leeds are 2 points clear at the top. They host Derby, who are 6th. That's tomorrow night. Norwich go to West Brom. Sheffield United are at home to QPR. And Middlesbrough, who are 5th, are at Birmingham, who are 8th, 4 points off the playoffs. So the landscape of that Championship table could change dramatically just through this one set of games.
Yeah, it's all, and I imagine it will do between now and the end of the season. There doesn't seem to be one or even two outstanding teams, I don't think, in the division. I think that it's not just the top six that's up for grabs, it's the top two as well. And so there's potential for the Stokes to sort themselves out and get themselves in the mix. But yeah, it could well be a pivotal weekend, I suppose, given the fixtures that we've got.
Yeah, and with it being so tight at the top, I mean, this time last year, Wolves, I think, were 12 points clear. You know, now Leeds are 2 points clear, Norwich aren't far behind, West Brom. There's a lot of teams in the mix, as you said. And, is this a big window? Do you think there could be a club who think, we're in a great position here, let's throw money at some transfers, let's try and get... Because it could be so marginal.
Well, a lot of it is a bit of a loan window, isn't it, with the confusion about Abraham's future, for example, at Villa, and Barnes, who's been so good for West Brom. You know, it's hanging on to players and who else you can look to bring in who's perhaps looking for a move down from the Premier League. So I don't think we'll see any club splashing tons and tons of cash, really. It'll be more sort of who's available for that loan deal, I reckon.
Yeah, that could well be right. I feel like Villa are the team who have the capability to spend the money. They can do it under FFP because they've got a new owner. And I think, one new forward alongside Abrahams could really sort of tip them over. I feel like West Brom have got the best squad, but they're really chock-a-block. They've got lots of options. It's about getting the best from about them getting consistency. Yeah. Sure, Sheffield United would love to spend money, but probably don't have it. It's the same with us.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's no real spare cash at Bramall Lane, I don't think.
Leeds are being linked with lots of players. Well,
I was going to say, it would make a lot of sense for Leeds to do something, because, the big question mark with Bielsa and his methods have been, is it actually possible to sustain it over a full Championship season? The fact they've now lost 3 on the bounce in all competition, I haven't seen those games, I don't know exactly how it went down, but it would suggest that there might be a wobble there. And so adding a few bodies who have fresh energy and, who haven't having been doing the Bielsa thing for 6 months and don't have that in their legs could be a good thing.
It's a suggestion that some of the players Matthijs Klich and players who were really outstanding at the beginning of the season have dropped off a little bit in the last few games.
And he's made some interesting comments as well, Bielsa. His kind of philosophy is to have a small squad of first team players and then promote academy players if they get injured or suspended. The average age of the Leeds bench in their last 4 games is less than 19 years of age.
Yeah, I get that, but given how specific his system is, like, it's hard to throw someone in there who's never played that way before and immediately they have to know how it works. They spend so much time in pre-season learning the Bielsa ball. So I understand why it's not easy to do what I just said I think they should do. But that is a bit of a contradiction, that he prefers having a small squad when he plays this incredibly energy-sapping method. He once suggested that if the players were robots, my team would win every time. Unfortunately for him, they're not robots, and there are limits to what humans can withstand physically and psychologically.
He's cancelled the loan of Lewis Baker and returned him to Chelsea, so they've got a loan spot available. I think
he's gone straight back out somewhere as well.
Yeah,
he has.
Yeah,
Reading, yeah. The other interesting thing in the Championship this week has been the big Bolton's row with Forest Green.
Yeah, yeah. Talk us through that, John.
Forest Green striker Christian Deutsch, I think we pronounce it, or at least I'm going to pronounce it that way anyway, was on loan at Bolton from the start of the season, supposed to be a season-long loan. He's been recalled by Forest Green because Bolton have apparently not paid his wages over the course of the season, and it's just sparked an entertaining row between the Forest Green owner and the Bolton owner, who have had this incredible war of words in the press. Forest Green have offered Bolton fans a free pint if they come and watch their game away at Bury in a couple of weeks. They've produced a T-shirt which says "No Can Do." Bolton's chairman is Ken Anderson. Anderson responded with a long statement on the Bolton website, quoting Churchill and mentioning the Forest Green's chairman, who is the owner of Ecotricity, the sort of green energy company, basically sort of attacking his business record and talking about redundancies and questioning whether 3 pints of beer is will be green or what the environmental impact
very
will be.
Trumpy, I thought.
It's, just Ken this complete rant written down on the page. Bolton have threatened to make their own T-shirt saying "Yes, we can."
Oh,
so it's really a high level of debate.
Look forward to that, seeing how many of those then they sell. Yeah.
Well, Bolton are third bottom, 3 points off safety, so that they're not in a great position. Someone who's a club that's in an even worse position. I don't want to sound too biased here, but Ipswich Town, 10 points adrift. Well, adrift from safety anyway, at the bottom, and they play Rotherham this weekend, who are fourth from bottom. It's difficult to see them getting out of this anyway, but if they don't win on Saturday...
There's so many games in the Championship, you know, you could, if it's possible, you know, you go on a run at the end of the season and win sort of, you know, 8 of the last 10 and you could still stay up. It's about whether you've sort of curdled the milk by that point and whether the team can still believe. I think Paul Lambert is making lots and lots of positive noises all the time. They've signed Colin Kwana from Huddersfield and he was half decent in the Championship, so they are recruiting. But yeah, that's sort of when you get to double figures, it seems like, it becomes a psychological thing as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, going on to League One, we mentioned earlier about Luton, they're second. They go to Sunderland in third. Portsmouth have a 5-point lead at the top there at home to Blackpool. On to League Two, another big game at the top. Bury, who are third, host MK Dons, who are second, just a point behind them. Lincoln City are still top. They've got a 4-point lead and go to mid-table Swindon. I think, gents, that just about wraps it up for today. I know Max usually offers some questions here about football robots and other weird topics that go off on a tangent, but I've not got that in my locker, I'm afraid. People, obviously, feel free to get your questions in for Monday's pod. Questions are preferable over abuse, so...
Abuse is just... I think we're... I mean, it's just... Enter abuse. There's no need for abuse. It doesn't add anything. It doesn't even have that shock value anymore. Everybody just abuses all the time, particularly women. Let's just stop it.
Hang on, you started the pod with having a dig at all the TalkSport mentions.
That is not a dig. That is a thing that couldn't be said. That's the
And
the,
we did. I didn't think we did.
No, exactly. No.
I didn't even mention another rival. I said a sports TV channel.
You did a proper Blue Peter job on that, and I'm very impressed, Melissa.
Yeah, thanks. I've got one thing right today, at least. But I like to think that, you know, Max's stock rises because everyone's like, when's he coming back from holiday? Everyone takes an interest in him. So, you know, I am helping him too. So
there we go.
He might not come back.
Well,
I mean, you know,
has he gone for ski or sun? Do we know?
I think he's gone to Australia.
He's gone to Australia.
Yeah, Barry's also on holiday, an unknown destination. A few 4 a.m. tweets.
We can narrow in the destination. It's something that serves alcohol, yeah?
Yeah, there was, I think there was
not gone to Dubes.
A fruit machine, a cigarette. It was like, what country am I in?
Oh.
And you could see that it was Euros. So All we know is somewhere in Europe.
I think I know, but I feel like I'll ruin the Twitter quiz if I say I was planning on a couple of weeks back. I was going to book a holiday, and I opened my browser to go on the site and book all the things because I've been thinking about it for a while. And then, as I opened my browser, the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer news was the first thing I saw, and I thought, "Oh no, no, no holiday."
So you didn't book. You still haven't booked one.
No, I think I might like go for something. I might, when the season's over, like I said, I get so discombobulated and confused when I go away mid-season, as I decided not to do it. I might go for like a week to sort of go mountain hiking in the Alps or something after the end of the season, or something less ambitious like hill walking in Austria or something. Yeah, it'd be good.
That sounds good. I doubt very much Barry Glendening is doing either of those things.
I don't think that,
wherever he's gone on holiday, but everyone will get to find out on Monday because he'll be back on the pod. For today, Paul, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Lars, lovely to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks, Mel.
And John, thanks for you too.
Cheers.
See you all on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.